Hey, my name is Dori Zinkin. I'm the principal of Tall Oaks Classical School in Newark, Delaware. And we're going to talk today about reading in the later grammar and the dialectic levels and what that should look like and what we're laying the foundations for. When our students are out of the pre-poly stage, that kind of K through 2 stage, they're reading most words quite fluently, and they can apply their phonic skills to sound out the rest, and they're able to understand the basic meaning of grade level texts, and they can sequence events from a story. So are they really equipped now to take on the world of reading, needing only to apply their present skills to increasingly difficult texts? I would argue no, that there is still much for them to learn. There is a grammar, a logic, and a rhetoric of reading, and reading skills continue to develop into adulthood. Therefore, as classical educators, we need to continue to teach reading skills throughout the trivium and as they apply to the content areas that we're teaching. The ability to learn from, understand, and interpret written texts are characteristics that distinguish the lifelong learner, and that's what we want. We want lifelong learners that are able to learn whatever they need to know, either for their enjoyment or for the various callings that God might have for them through their lives. At our school, we have an annual State of the School meeting every year in January, and we invited graduates to come back one year and talk about their experiences after they left Tall Oaks. And I want to read you a quote from one of those talks from a Mr. Brant Hauser, who was actually one of our earliest graduates. And I think that's important here. A lot of y'all are in startup schools and you're just beginning, and you think, especially at a conference like this, you see, oh, how far ahead so many others are than we are, and are we ever going to get there? And I think this might be encouraging to you, because this is a graduate who only spent 4 years at our school, because it started when he was 4 years from graduation, and yet still as imperfectly as it was what we gave him, it still benefited him quite a bit. Brant says, "What I found in college classrooms were high school graduates with little or no idea how to process the information given to them. Their learning process mimicked the learning process our first graders employ here at Tall Oaks. Listen, memorize, repeat. Even more apparent was their lack of ability to piece together a sound logical argument, much less a coherent sentence. Let me remind you that these observations impressed me while I was in the honors program. These students were supposed to be Delaware's best and brightest. My favorite example came in an honors colloquium class entitled Freedom and Equality. The class was meant to be a relatively open forum discussion on the difficulties in simultaneously enforcing both freedom and equality in a society. It was a disaster. Time after time, the students would come in to class having read the assignments, most of which were the founding documents of this country, and having absorbed none of the meaning. This course was nothing more than a volley of canned arguments the students had heard elsewhere. Prodding them for any explanation would yield a repeat of the argument at a higher volume. This was a class with two students who had scored 1,600 on their SATs. Believe me now when I say that being smart had nothing to do with thriving in that setting. The tools to learn that were instilled in me at Tall Oaks were what enabled my comprehension of the subject and my ability to discuss it intelligently. This was a theme that I found threaded throughout my years of undergraduate and graduate studies at both the University of Delaware and the University of Idaho. Whether it was English 101 or honors chemistry or my architectural thesis, I found myself thankful to God for the meager 4 years I had here learning about more than just the grammar of life." I share that with you. Brant said that so much better than I could, so I use his words. And the point here is not to gloat about how much better we are than other schools, or to glory in that, but to you know, I think Brant wasn't reading like that when he left third grade or fourth grade or fifth grade. The instruction goes on. But what really makes him different from so many of his college classmates who likely got themselves through college and then never picked up a founding document of this country again, or any other meaty text for that matter. And yet he still does, and still goes on, and still develops as a leader and as a learner. So when we need to talk about how it is those, we need to consciously teach those reading skills and how they happen, and that's what we want to look at today. It makes sense not to necessarily have a reading class beyond the grammar years, but we still need to develop the reading abilities of our students as we teach the disciplines in the dialectic and the rhetoric schools. Each discipline, whether it's the literature or theology or science or history, has its own kinds of texts. And our students need to be able to deal with all of them if they are to advance their studies in these fields. Of course, the most important text to Christians is the Bible, which is a challenging mixture of genres and styles, and of which misunderstanding has lifelong consequences. So my purpose here today is to look at reading instruction in the upper grammar school and in the dialectic school that lays a foundation upon which rhetoric-level reading can develop. How to Read a Book was written by Mortimer Adler and Charles Van Doren. If you haven't read it, I suggest you do. It was life-changing for me. What a humbling thing, you know, the book is called How to Read a Book. So when I was first told I had to read How to Read a Book, I thought, well, if I can't, I couldn't. And, you know, if I can read it, I could probably write it. But I must say my hubris was quickly humbled because it revealed to me that I really wasn't reading at the level that we would like to see, the level of a lifelong learner. And so if you'd like a little humbling and you haven't read that book yet, please do so. It's a very helpful book. But he talks in that book about... Oh, I went up, didn't I? Didn't mean to. Okay. He talks in that book about different levels of reading, the first of which is elementary reading. Elementary reading is just decoding the words that are on the page. That's your basic phonics. It's also understanding basic meanings, whether they're explicit or implied. Okay, we heard the weather report, so we decided to bring our umbrellas. Okay, it's implied. The weather report said it was raining or going to rain. But that's basic meaning. That's elementary reading. And this should be happening pretty proficiently by the time they leave that first half of the grammar school, that pre-poly part. The next level that is referred to in Adler's book is inspectional reading. This is something I'd been exposed to in school, but I had never really learned this as a habit, and it's a habit for me now, and it's been a very important one. It's inspectional reading is systematic skimming. It's skimming with a purpose. I did a lot of skimming in school. It was mostly to get out of actually reading the thing. So this is a very different sort of skimming. You determine the structure and the parts of the text. How is it organized? What are the chapters? Determine what the text is about. And when you say what it's about, that's very specific. It's not... you know, this is about the Battle of Troy. It's more specific. What's the extent? What's the scope? What are the limits of the book? What kind of text is it? What is its genre? And determine what questions or problems the author is attempting to address. Generally speaking, if I'm going to study a book, I do this first, and it really puts you on a much better footing for then going back and reading the book more carefully and analytically. If you do a systematic skimming first, you give yourself the background and the basis for understanding the book. So it's an important thing. And whether we're talking about a book or even an article, an essay, it's an important skill. Okay, the next level, which Adler calls level 3, is analytical reading. And this is when you do a thorough and complete reading of the book. And what's very important here is that on that second bullet point, there is the word active. Analytical reading is an active process. You don't read the words and let them flow over your brain, which is what so often I know I've done. But it's a very active reading where you try to gain understanding. You think about your own understanding. Did you get that or not? Or do you have to go back and check it again? You need to identify and understand the author's use of terms. What does this author mean when he says liberty? Identify and understand the author's leading propositions. What is he setting out to establish? Identify and understand the sequence, that's supposed to be of, not foe, sequence of the arguments that the author is making. Determine which problems or questions were solved and whether or not the author knows whether or not they solved it. Distinguish fact from opinion. And determine where the author is uninformed, misinformed, illogical, or incomplete in his account or his analysis. A lot of these things, by the way, seem to apply only to nonfiction works, but they don't. There is an overflow into fiction here as well. Even fiction has an argument. All right, then the highest level, and this is really your rhetoric level reading, is syntopical reading. Syntopical reading is a comparative reading of multiple works. You want to hear what more than one author has to say about the same question. What you're starting out with is a specific question or problem that you want the answer to. And there may not be an author that actually answered your question exactly the way that you've posed it or the way that you have it. So you need to go about finding from multiple works what different authors have said that would contribute to answering that question. Syntopical reading does not mean reading a lot of books on the same subject. You're reading a lot of books to answer the same question. You may not read the whole books. You're just going to read the parts that matter to the question that you've asked. And you need to. One of the things you need to do is come to an understanding how each of these authors use terms, and if necessary, construct neutral terms. What I mean by that is different authors may use words in different ways, or they may use different words for the same concept. And somehow you've got to come to terms with that, and you've got to pull that all together in order to do syntopical reading. You need to define the leading issues and how each author answers them. So let's take Brandt's subject of balancing freedom and equality. What are the leading questions in that issue? You have to determine what that is. Is it the role of the law, how far the law goes? Talk about the role of other authorities. And so all those things become issues, and then you have to look at how each author answers those issues that are within the scope of your question. You have to determine what each work contributes to the discussion, And then the ultimate goal of syntopical reading is to construct an original analysis that is not in any of the works. Now, at our school, we have junior and senior thesis, and that's the kind of reading that has to go into constructing a thesis, the syntopical reading. Okay, so if you teach 5th grade or 7th grade or 8th grade, how is it that we're preparing our students to be able to reach this level of reading and reach this level of analysis? Well, I'll look at some general principles first. One is that our understanding builds on our prior knowledge. As teachers then, and then this is a known to the unknown, one of our 7 laws, as teachers then we need to be able to figure out where our students are, what their present experiences are, what their present skills are, in order to build on that. And in the approach to any new work, new text that we're going to study, we need to help the students to attach this new material or these new themes to previous knowledge or experiences that they have. Another principle is that we integrate with the content areas, especially at this age, upper grammar, dialectic age. They shouldn't be doing reading for reading's sake. We have to do that when they're learning to sound out words and they read some text that might not be worth their time otherwise if they weren't good phonics practice. But at this age, we should show them an example of reading texts that matter. It's teaching them their science or their history or it's wonderful literature that we love and is worth reading. So we want to make sure that we're integrating their reading with content areas and not teaching reading in isolation in upper grammar or dialectic. All teachers are reading teachers at these levels. So the 7th grade history teacher is a reading teacher. The 7th grade science teacher is a science teacher. I'm the one with the phone going off. Okay. Another principle is to teach students to read actively. We'll get into that more in a moment. One way to do that, by the way, is to model your own active reading to them. Your own active reading is not something that they can see unless you tell them about it. So as you read aloud with your students, you can pause and model to them the kind of active reading that's going on inside your head. I'm wondering, how are they going to get out of this dilemma? I'm wondering, you know, I predict, I don't quite understand what I just read. I'm going to go back and read that again. That kind of modeling of the internal thought processes so that they can learn them. They're not going to just pick them up necessarily. Maybe they will some, but if we're explicit about them, explain them to them, it's going to be far better. Teach students to monitor their own understanding. Again, if you've just read something and you don't know what it is, you go back and read it again. Teach the students to do that as well. Pause and see, can I reconstruct what I've just read? Can I see that he's taken 3 steps in this argument now? Do I remember what they are? Go back, that kind of active monitoring of their own understanding. All right, I want to talk a little bit about teaching vocabulary. We can think about 3 different degrees here of understanding a word, understanding a vocabulary word. First is being able to provide a basic definition of it when others use it. So I'm reading along and I come across a word and, oh yeah, I remember that one, I remember what it means, and I can provide a dictionary definition of it. The word's not really a good friend, but it's an acquaintance. Or perhaps I know it a little better than that, and I can perceive the subtleties and shades of meaning that distinguish one word from another similar word, a word with a similar meaning. And so now I not only get the dictionary meaning, but I get that sense of why the author chose that word, why that one's different than another one, and why that's better to communicate the thought that the author was trying to communicate. But best of all, of course, is being able to use the word myself to communicate shades of meaning, to know why a word that I can choose to say exactly what it is I want to say. When I talk about shades of meaning, think about a word like prospective, something you're looking forward to, something that's coming up, versus a word like portentous. Well, something that's portentous is coming up too, but it's looming and it's ominous and it's not a good thing. So those shades of meaning, why I might choose one or the other, is an important mastery. That represents mastery of that word. We need to teach vocabulary in context as much as possible. I'm not against vocabulary books. We use them some in our school. But studies have really shown that studying words in context is far more effective to getting to that third stage of really having the word be a good friend. And so as much as possible, we should pull vocabulary out of context, out of its reading. We should focus, when you do that, focus on the present usage of the word. In other words, how the word is being used in the context you've got it. And if it has other meanings in other situations, then you're not necessarily pointing all those out at once. When teaching vocabulary, give attention to the etymology of the word. Look at words with similar roots. So let's say perspective again. You're doing perspective. How about spectacles, spectator? Some words that they might know. Go to the Latin. You know, pro in this case means forward, and spective to see. Look at those roots. Put them together to give them a fuller understanding of the word. Isabel L. Beck is a researcher, and she's done a lot of research in vocabulary and learning vocabulary. And this is a very helpful model to me when I'm thinking about what words do we want to focus on. Tier 1 words are those common words that almost everybody knows. Yesterday, house, running. It's not very often that you need much explanation, if any, of those words in the classroom. The word house, it could be used as a verb to house. We're going to house the students. Maybe that's a meaning that the students don't know. But just a moment's explanation will make it clear to them, and they'll be able to pick it up because they're so familiar with the noun. Tier 2 words are those high-utility words that are used frequently in sophisticated adult communication. Some examples there: incessantly, repertoire, countenance. These are the words we need to focus on in our vocabulary studies. By saying they're high utility, it means they really are going to see them in lots of different works. They're going to come across them in other things, and teaching these words will increase their understanding more than focusing on more obscure words. Tier 3 words are words that are used infrequently and usually in discussion of specialized topics. So a word like isotope. Now those words, I'm not saying we don't teach those words, but those words are taught as the concept is taught. In a science class, you would teach the word isotope when you're teaching the concept of an isotope. So that makes sense to learn that vocabulary then. But if very specialized words appear in reading that kids are doing in the classroom, it doesn't make sense to spend a lot of time. It would make more sense to just give them the definition and move on if it appears in a story or something. The same thing is true of words that are archaic and perhaps are used in a... I was reading The Bride Comes to Yellow Sky from Stephen Crane with a group earlier this week. And the word drummer is in there, meaning a salesman, a traveling salesman. And we don't use the word drummer to mean traveling salesman. I'm not going to do a big vocabulary lesson on that. They probably won't encounter it ever again. So what makes sense is to tell them what's meant by that and move on rather than make that into a into a vocabulary lesson. Okay, and this is from Bride Comes to Yellow Sky. If the citizens could dream of his prospective arrival with his bride, they would parade the band at the station and escort them amid cheers and laughing, congratulations, and laughing congratulations to his adobe home. All right, I just want to give you a little example of how I might handle that word in the classroom. First is to read it in context and discuss with the students what the meaning of the word is. They may have an idea, they may have a slightly wrong idea, or they might have part of it. So we discuss it, correct their misperceptions, and get a working definition of the word. Then we would discuss the roots of the word. Again, prospective, put it together, think of other words that they could come up with that have similar roots. Discuss the nuances and subtleties that distinguish this word from words with similar meaning. I already talked about prospective and portentous. Well, what's the difference with prospective and upcoming? You know, upcoming sounds a little more certain. Prospective is a maybe upcoming. So there's shades of meaning there that we can talk about. After arriving at a good definition, put the word into other contexts and try to apply it to the students' experiences. Businesses on their websites have pages for prospective employees. Under what circumstances might you read these pages? Can you think of a time when you were excited or anxious about a prospective event? These kind of conversations then get them using the word a little bit in its broader use. Then put the word back into the original context, read it again, and use the definition to explain it. So have the students then explain what this sentence means. Okay. So if the citizens could only imagine that he might be coming home with a new wife, they would meet him at the station with a brass band. Okay. In future days and weeks, try to provide additional context and review by using the new words in the classroom or pointing out their use in text. A prospective student will be visiting our class tomorrow. I'm sure you'll help her feel welcome. You can also use, there's a number of things you can do for review, word walls, pocket charts, cards, things to keep both you and the students reviewing these words. Okay. All right, I want to talk about reading skills. Now, on your outline, you've probably heard all the speakers mention that we have to turn these outlines 3 months in advance or something. But on your outline, I separated grammar and dialectic skills and methods, and I'm going to do them together because I found myself repeating myself too much. So there's a flow from one to the other that I think you'll be able to understand. So skills to teach and practice in the grammar and the dialectic school. First is determining the organization of the text. And teach them to use all those parts of a book that are there to help them to do that. The table of contents, the chapter headings, subheadings, index, back of the book. Look for topic sentences, for summaries at the end of chapters. All those things that help us to organize it, to see the organization of it. Determine the purpose of the book, including the main topic and the scope. Purpose in a persuasive or nonfiction work can be rather straightforward. Purpose in fiction is a little bit more difficult to determine, especially for grammar school students, but do push them on that. Okay. And don't be satisfied with statements of purpose that are too general. This book was written about bees is too general. What about bees? The different kinds, how they live? How they are kept for producing honey. What's the scope and the limits of that book? Also, they should be able to figure out what information is not in the book. And as they're looking at the organization of it, they should learn to find out where it is, where to locate within the book, where is the information that they might be looking for. Another skill is connecting the work to prior knowledge and experience. This is a habit that, you need to not just do for the students, but you need to teach the students to do for themselves. What do I already know about this topic? How is this character like someone I know? How does this character feel like I once felt? Find topic sentences and summaries within the book. And this one is especially important for grammar school. It's very difficult for grammar school students to recognize that texts have human authors who lie and make mistakes and don't know everything, just like everybody else, that being an author doesn't all of a sudden put you in some exalted status where everything you said is correct. So they need to have a respect, yet a healthy skepticism for what they're reading. They need to distinguish fact from opinion. In fiction, it's especially important to determine whether the author is narrating or if a character is giving his point of view. This concept of perspective is very difficult for grammar students. You should introduce it then, but you should really develop this in the dialectic. A character can be mistaken. They could be operating with less than full information. Very often the reader knows more than a character in the story knows. And a grammar school student reading that may not understand that the character didn't read the narration and had a different experience. So you have to be very careful to point that out and work with them on that. It may take a long time. When Elizabeth Bennet says, "Mr. Darcy is a proud and disagreeable man," is she stating a fact or an opinion? Is it subject to change? Does she not have all the information? So, right. You also need to be able to evaluate the surety of facts too. You don't have to have a big epistemological discussion every time, but you need to look at whether a fact is well established or not. They need to think about, as you go back in history further in time, you're forming opinions and theories on less and less information. Even if you think about a recent history, if you think about whether the typical American experience in the last presidential election or the last war or something, you are going to get many, many different stories, and our own memories are not so hot. And so as we look through these texts with the students, they need to think about how sure are we of these facts. When we're studying ancient Egypt, you can be pretty sure we've made a lot of mistakes in what we're presenting to them as facts. And it's okay, but that's the nature of the study of history. But they need to recognize that. All right. Identifying setting, plot, characters in fictional works. This is grammar school more than dialectic. But this basic needs to be accomplished in the grammar in order to support dialectic and rhetoric level thinking about the works. They also need to be taught to support their conclusions or interpretations with the text. When discussing a work of fiction, wild speculation about what might have happened outside of the events recorded in the story are not good interpretive practice. That's not good interpretation. When they have an opinion about what happened, they need to be able to point to something in the text that supports that. It's very important. You're probably not there. They can learn that in grammar school, but it needs to be worked on all the way through. When they get to the rhetoric level, they shouldn't be doing that. They shouldn't be speculating rather than interpreting. Okay? And we need to teach them to ask questions of the text. They need to be taught inspectional reading. We talked earlier about what that is, so I won't spend a lot of time on it now. But they do need to pick out the author's purposes and themes, organization, how the author's using terms. Okay, we have to recognize the influences on perspective of the author or the characters, such as worldview, experience, knowledge or ignorance, culture, time period, previously read works, etc. All these influence how an author's perspective on the subject, and also within a book, a character's perspective. And we want to teach our students to recognize that. We also want them to recognize the author's craft. And this is something, by the time they finish grammar school, they should have a pretty good working vocabulary as far as things like mood, plot, rhythm, alliterations, allusions. All these literary devices ought to be things that they can recognize, that they can see. Symbolism and theme, you're getting up into dialectic more then. Back to this point about an author's perspective, their own experiences. My father went through World War II in Britain, and I have many cousins over there as well that, you know, I meet from time to time. And when they talk about their experiences in World War II, they went through some really agonizing times before the U.S. got in the war, when they were getting bombed, and in the United States we were having legislative sessions and committee meetings and such on whether or not we should get in the war. And they really looked at us as we have the power to, you know, to be decisive in the war, and we're having meetings and all this. And I often think about that when I think about Tolkien in the Battle of Middle Earth, and the Ents are there, you know, deliberating, you know, this is a we're going to have a meeting, and not until their own are attacked do they decide to really get in. So, you know, I think about Tolkien as he wrote that, and how his experience in war colored his rendition of what war is like and what alliances in war are like. Probably wasn't talking about us directly, but you know, that experience colored his view of how those things happen. And it's interesting to look into the biographies of authors and look at what their perspective is and how these things influence them. Okay, we also need to teach them to identify the form of the author's arguments in both fiction and nonfiction. Remember, fiction has an argument too. Perhaps the author's arguing that a character is unable to avoid his weaknesses and is to be pitied rather than held responsible for his actions. Maybe he's arguing that life is random and has no meaning. Or maybe he's arguing that meaning is in relationships. So all these different things are arguments that you might find in fiction as well. So we need to identify arguments in both fiction and nonfiction so that they can be examined. You need to examine the sources of an author's information in recognizing a poorly sourced work. So you need to learn to examine those endnotes, those footnotes. This is more dialectic. We need to evaluate the truth of an author's propositions or assumptions. So once we've understood what an author has to say, then we can ask the question, is it true? Then we can evaluate it. Not until we interpret it, not until we interpret what he said can we be in a position to do that. We also can evaluate whether or not the author was successful in what he was trying to do and what he was trying to say. All right, modeling active, these are teaching methods now. Modeling active reading is one I already spoke of, and that's that thinking out loud so that they can think about their own thinking. Another good assignment for grammar school is fact-finding. Can they find the information they need within a work? So that forces them to use those tools that are there to help us to do that. Indexes, chapter headings, whatever. So sending them to find information. Now, the reason I put nonfiction there is That's not the point of fiction. The point of fiction is not what the name of Susie's dog was, or you know, that's really not the point. And if you send them on fact-finding missions for fiction, you're going to spoil it. They're going to spoil what the point is. My husband and I have friends that had a girl in high school, and she was failing her literature class. And knowing I was a teacher, they brought some of her work and her things to me to say, can you help her with this? And as I read through the assignments and the tests that she had to do, my heart just sunk. It was all this nitpicky information from the text and nothing about what the author was trying to say, nothing about the beauty of it. The whole point of the literature was gone because she was being taught to read as a data collector. As she read through this text, it's like, if I'm going to pass this test, I've got to memorize all these details. And what a sad thing. I really couldn't help her pass this class because that's the way this class was. And, you know, what could I do but say, I hope that you have this time and experience at some point where you can learn to love this, because this is a great book and, you can't appreciate it doing this. But we need to be careful that we're not sending kids on fact-finding missions through fiction that doesn't make sense to what the point of the book is. Inspectional reading assignments, though, it is a better thing to do, and you can do this with fiction as well. And that is, you want to give them assignments that force them to go back into the text and start putting things together. I talk about journaling here. Just open-ended journaling is not a good idea until they've been taught to do it. And the way you teach them to do it is to give them guided journaling experiences. So where they are sent to find what you've asked for and answer the questions that you've asked for. And these are good pre-discussion assignments. These are good assignments to have before you have an interpretive discussion, which we'll talk more about interpretive discussions here in a minute. But so I'm on the Bride Comes to Yellow Sky again because I just read it. So one question might be to choose one of the three main characters of the story and note what the author says about his or her clothing and reflect on these descriptions and tell what they tell us about the character. That's because that's a device that this author used in this story to send a certain message. I know that, they don't. But I'm sending them out there to find that so that they can put that together and do that analysis. You can ask questions about that help them to note the author's craft, like what purpose do the men in the saloon serve in advancing the story? You know, why are they there? They're really not active in the story. But there's a reason that they're there. They're there to give us the background on the story. Okay. When East and West are mentioned, how are each characterized? What people or things are associated with this? This is a big theme in this story. This helps them to zero in on that, helps them pick on how he uses color and light. You can ask a question on that so that they go about, they start to note these things. These are good pre-discussion questions because it gets them very intimately associated with the text so that when we try to interpret it together later, they have a lot to work on. They have a lot in their mind already. And by the way, when you do that, they do remember the details because now the details have meaning. Now they remember that Scratchy Wilson's shirt was red, flannel, because it's part of the story, it's important to the story, and they understand why. But to just ask that question in isolation, ask them to remember that is pointless on its own. Okay, note-taking organizers are another good thing for pre-discussion. You've seen them, graphic organizers. You pick a character, what do people say about the character? What's the character say about himself? What does the narrator say about this character? Those kinds of organizers are very helpful, especially in the grammar school, of putting together the information so they can gather it up as they read the story. want to talk about discussions a little bit. There are basically three kinds of questions that can be asked during discussion. One is factual questions, and these ask for information that's stated either explicitly or can be easily inferred, and there's always a right answer and a wrong answer, and someone gives the answer, and that's it. There's no discussion. Okay? So factual questions are not very helpful if you want to have a good discussion. Interpretive questions, however, have more than one possible answer. And they usually begin with why. Why didn't Scratchy Wilson shoot the sheriff? Why did the character do this or that? Why did the author use this device? And then you have evaluative questions. And these judge the effectiveness of the author's craft or the truth of his assertions. Was it effective, the mood he tried to, or did it just come off flat? Was it true, what this author said about life? Okay. And the most important thing about evaluative questions is they really can't happen before interpretation. You have to thoroughly interpret a work before you can make a fair evaluation of it. Otherwise, you're just spouting your opinions, and it's not genuine interpretation of the work. Okay, so here's the rules. This is how you carry on a discussion. All your participants must have read the text and completed the pre-discussion assignments. If they haven't, they may listen, but you don't let them participate. Okay. All ideas must be supported by the text. Avoid speculation, as we talked about before. You need to train your students to respond respectfully to the ideas of others. And that doesn't mean you're discouraging them from disagreeing. You're actually encouraging disagreement. But you want to and other ideas. But you need to teach them to do so with respect, and they need to respond to the ideas and not to the person. Okay? Oh, you always say that because you're what? And that's not it's not a fit response. Okay, participants should be encouraged to speak to each other and not to the teacher. As much as possible, if the teacher can throw out the questions and manage the discussion somewhat and not be a part of it, that's ideal. Okay, for discussion leaders, and I might add that discussion leader is not necessarily a teacher. In the dialectic level, they should be getting to the point where they can start being discussion leaders too. And they can start forming the interpretive questions. The teacher may not be the only one supplying interpretive questions. We need to teach kids to write them. Okay, but the leaders ask interpretive questions, but they do not answer them. And it is so hard sometimes when you're leading some of these discussions and they just don't seem to get it and it's not quite there. It's so hard to avoid the temptation to supply an answer, but we really need to do that. We need to teach them to do this. Leaders can summarize, they can probe for clarification, and very important, ask for textual support. Don't let them speculate. Don't let them get too far afield. Allow for pauses and time for reflection. It's really okay if nobody's talking for a minute. Encourage disagreement and focus the discussion when it gets off track. And one of the hardest things is this keeping a record. The hardest thing is how do you grade a discussion? You know, and I don't have a real clear answer other than to say that what I generally do is I'll make a picture, like a seating chart, put the names of the people that are around the table. You can use your own little code as to who said what and scribble by each name as the discussion goes on. You know, put dots by their name if they contributed to the discussion and see how many dots everybody gets. One of the hardest things is getting those who talk too much to wait for others, you know, give others a chance to contribute. So that's something you have to manage too. Sometimes that's best managed by talking to the student alone after class and saying, you know, you've got some great ideas and we need to help the others to contribute as well. So, you know, work out a plan for that. But very often, the real way, and you can gather, you can kind of get a grading system out of that of your own if you like. But probably a better thing to do is a writing assignment that's a follow-up to the discussion. And then the writing assignment is an interpretive essay of some kind, and you can do that to produce a grade then. Oh, that's the end. Okay. All right. Another thing which I didn't write on there, but I was probably missed to leave off, is the use of debate. It was similar to discussion, but use of debate in rhetoric, or I mean in dialectic level when you're reading nonfiction. Debate is very helpful because if they know they have to argue one side of an argument, then they have to get into the work and really get what the arguments and the points are in order to present their argument. So to do that, they have to read analytically. So it forces them into it, and they love it. They really like it. So it doesn't have to be a formal debate, but some sort of assignment where they know they have to argue one side or another of it. Okay. Do we have any questions? Nope. All right. Well, we're 2 minutes early. That's pretty good timing for me. All right. Oh, we got one here. Thank you. The question was, for sake of the tape, was how many books do you read in a year? I'm not saying we don't have a fixed number in our curriculum guides on a fixed number. I am a big proponent of short stories for fiction. Not that we don't read whole, we do read a lot of whole works too. But sometimes this interpretation is better done on a smaller work because you can look at the whole thing. When you're looking at a larger work, you have to, in order to discuss, you have to pick a chapter or two or a section of the book. You do that, but it's a little harder. So I don't have a fixed number. I would say probably most of our grammar school probably do 6 to 8 novels through the course of the year, and then they do other short stories and poetry and things besides. Dialectic level literature, probably about the same. I don't know. Maybe more. Maybe one a month-ish. Sorry, that's not a very exact answer. Anything else? Okay. Thank you.